Reed's movements and passing the intelligence quickly and efficiently to Tian Dia. Tian Dia lit up a cigarette, took a deep drag, and said in a near whisper that he needed Henri to deliver an order to someone named Jeannot about the American immediately, and warned the officer that the Gestapo may have made Tian Dia at the Frascati. As always, Henri followed Tian Dia's orders to the letter. Less than an hour later, Jeannot, wearing the black Gestapo uniform, embarked upon his mission. Tian Dia's best and most fearsome inside man, he terrified even the most vicious Gestapo agents with his huge shoulders and chest, his jutting jawed, deeply creased visage, and feral amber eyes. No one in Toulouse even knew where he had come from. The simple fact was that people feared him, and that allowed him to convince the Gestapo of his high value. A trusted Nazi sympathizer, the giant Frenchman had risen to second in command of the Toulouse Gestapo, and none of the Germans questioned his loyalty. No one suspected that Jeannot was a Mirage agent who had been passing intelligence to Tian Dia for months. Further, no one suspected that Tian Dia had five other men working for the Gestapo as clerks with access to sensitive documents. Time after time, Jeannot had helped Tian Dia and other resistance men and women elude capture or betrayal. The task Tian Dia had just relayed to the operative, however, was the riskiest that Tian Dia had ever given him. Although Jeannot knew that one misstep on his part could ruin Tian Dia and Morange, he understood that Tian Dia would not relent. With Tian Dia commanding that the matter be resolved immediately, Jeannot knew what he had to do, even if it meant blowing his cover. Jeannot took a deep breath, walked up the steps of the Gestapo headquarters, opened the heavy steel doors with little effort, and entered. He glowered at a young Gestapo agent manning the front desk. At the sight of Jeannot in his black hat, emblazoned with the skull and crossbones emblem, the agent nearly fell as he scrambled from his chair to salute him. Jeannot demanded to know where the prisoner from the Frascati was being held, and whether he had confessed to anything, or had revealed any names of his associates. Pale, his mouth quivering, the agent pointed down the corridor and shook his head no. Relieved that the American had said nothing, Jeannot stormed past the German and sent him sprawling to the stone floor with a shove. Jeannot turned a corner, glanced back to where the agent was still lying on the floor, and leaned against the cold, wet granite wall. Closing his eyes for a moment, he inhaled deeply and slowly exhaled. Step one was complete. He walked up to Arthur's cell and reached into his pocket for his keys. With a metallic rasp, the heavy, scarred steel door opened. Arthur was crumpled on the bare stone floor in the fetal position, his clothes tattered and his swollen face streaked with blood. For a moment, Jeannot feared that the American was dead, but then Arthur groaned. Jeannot moved with a speed unusual for a man of his size. The crunch of boots against stone signaled that other Gestapo agents were rushing down the corridor to assist him with the prisoner. As soon as they arrived at the open cell, Jeannot kicked the prone American in the back and ordered him to his feet. Behind him, several officers stared and inched back a few steps. Jeannot intimidated even the most sadistic of his fellow Gestapo agents. He reached down, grabbed Arthur's collar, and hauled him to his feet as if the prisoner weighed merely a few pounds. As the other Gestapo agents scattered, he dragged the groaning Arthur out of the cell and down the hall. Without looking back, Jeannot informed anyone within earshot that he was transferring the prisoner to solitary in a smaller Gestapo building reserved for captives about to disappear. No one followed him. None of the Gestapo men believed that the prisoner would even make it to solitary. Jeannot's special interest in him meant that the massive French collaborator had likely decided to take the man somewhere, torture and kill him, and then dump the body. Jeannot was counting on that belief. Several times before, he had removed prisoners and they had disappeared. His Gestapo colleagues never suspected that each of those prisoners had been a Mirage operative whom Taillandier could not afford to lose or to have reveal secrets under torture. Arthur was the first American Taillandier had ever ordered Jeannot to remove. Jeannot yanked the barely conscious Arthur out the front door of the headquarters and tossed him into the back seat of a dark sedan. Groggy, but certain he was about to be killed, Arthur lifted his blackened, bloody eyes and suddenly realized that the Gestapo agent was Jeannot. For a moment, he thought that he was hallucinating, that the man could not possibly be who he thought he was. Then the man behind the wheel inclined his head slightly back toward Arthur and nodded. Arthur recognized Robert, Taillandier's chauffeur. Then, from the front passenger seat, another man leaned over toward Arthur and smiled. Marcel Taillandier's face was the last thing Arthur saw before he passed out. At that moment, Arthur was far more fortunate than Giselle Chauvin and Pierre Dupin. Dupin was languishing in solitary confinement at Fresnes prison, left naked, battered, and unfed for days at a time until the next round of torture began. He had not given up anyone's name. The Gestapo had whisked Giselle from Le Spar to the Villa Calypso for her first round of questioning. And as Arthur was being arrested and subsequently rescued from the Gestapo, she was being held at Fort Douai, an ancient stone prison in Bordeaux. Her cell was one of those reserved for select prisoners. The bars were flat and held together by a traversed pair palming the vertical ones. There was also a wooden box trapped in front of it, preventing the prisoners from looking down, i.e. outside, as well as drawing attention to a little light coming in from the sky. She and the other select prisoners, most of them captured resistance members, had no toilet, no cot, no blanket, and were denied the once-a-week communal showers that other prisoners were allowed to take in the bastion's oldest tower, where the Germans forced prisoners to walk in a circle as ice-cold water cascaded down on them. Around the dank, tiny cells where Giselle and other special prisoners were suffering were lots of guards, a small army around them and within the fort itself. Much worse was in store for Giselle Chauvin, who had not surrendered one name or any other information about the resistance to her Nazi torturers. Another Fort Douai inmate, a Jewish man slated for transportation to the concentration camp at Buchenwald, wrote, "Sometimes we could hear prisoners being taken away early in the morning. We often heard brave women patriots singing the Marseillaise, the French national anthem. These women helped to boost our morale and pride in the cause, which was all we had left." Battered, deprived of sleep, and poorly fed, Giselle heard those voices one morning. Through her cracked, swollen lips, she mouthed the words of her anguished nation's anthem. Chapter 18. The Maquis. Taillandier's driver, Robert, navigated the black Citroën through Toulouse's late afternoon traffic, darting past buses, German army trucks and troop carriers, and other cars. As Taillandier and his 82 Mirage operatives knew and used to their advantage, few people other than officials, police, or Gestapo could drive automobiles because of the severe shortages of gas. Even the authorities assumed that any large Citroën or Mercedes sedans on the road belonged to them, not French civilians. Taillandier's deft use of the black market ensured that he always had enough gasoline hidden away for ambushes and essential errands. He had long ago decided that Arthur's safety and eventual escape were essential. And no one thought to stop Taillandier's car as it headed toward the outskirts of the city, whose pink-tinged bricks almost seemed to glow in the oncoming twilight. Arthur's quick thinking at the Frascati, dropping his photo identification card and papers to the floor and under the table, ensured that the Gestapo agent who had recognized him was the only one who could actually identify him as Georges Lambert. Jeannot would solve that problem quickly and mercilessly. The Gestapo man would simply disappear, or turn up as one more bullet-riddled Morange target, dumped lifeless into a ditch, or even cut down in broad daylight on the streets of Toulouse. Before exiting the city, Robert pulled over and let Jeannot out to take care of the matter. Once again, Taillandier's judgment that the American airman could think fast on his feet had proven correct. Arthur, slumped in the back seat and sliding in and out of consciousness, sensed little except the car's motion. Robert drove out of the city and followed a series of back roads that he knew with a native familiarity. He sped past vineyards and pastures framed by tree-lined ridges and hills. Some 15 miles from Toulouse, he darted onto a road that was little more than a cowpath, and stopped in a small clearing nearly surrounded by trees. He and Taillandier got out of the car, opened one of the passenger doors, and quickly but carefully slid Arthur out of the back seat and half-carried him to a long, low-slung structure with gray battered walls and a partially collapsed roof. They had brought Arthur to a maquis, a remote hideout used by resistance groups to elude capture and lie low when things were getting too hot. Throughout southern France, resistance groups would cleverly conceal maquis in the woods and hills. The word maquis refers to a thicket, bush, or scrub growth, and was originally a Corsican term that had made its way to mainland France. Resistance historian François Marcot, a professor of history at the Sorbonne, writes, "The term maquis signified both the bands of fighters and their rural location. The term established the image of a maquisard, as a committed and voluntary fighter, a combatant. Members of those bands were called maquisards. The term meant armed resistance fighter. The maquis have come to symbolize the French resistance." Inside the maquis, Arthur was greeted by 20 or so men hiding from the Gestapo and the Vichy police. He was able to open his swollen eyes just enough to find a familiar and welcome face smiling at him. Far from Lespar, Pierre Delude had fled to the Morange refuge out of fear that the Gestapo would be at his door following the arrest of the Chauvins and the destruction of Brutus. Taillandier and Robert left the hideout as quickly as they had arrived, planning to bring Arthur back to Toulouse once he was recovered, and once they were sure that the Gestapo agent had been removed. He would be safer in the city, because German foot and air patrols constantly combed the countryside for any sign of the maquis. As Arthur would soon learn, the hideout's inhabitants were armed with rifles, pistols, and even a few submachine guns to mount a fight if the Nazis discovered them. Shortly before Taillandier departed, he had slipped a small pistol into one of Arthur's pockets. Marcel left Arthur in good hands with the other men of the maquis. They were a colorful group of Frenchmen ranging from sophisticated urban physicians, lawyers, and businessmen, to waterfront toughs and rough-hewn farmers. Within a few days, with the doctors in the band tending to Arthur, he regained his strength, and the other men embraced the American as one of their own. From Pierre Delude, Arthur learned the horrifying details of what had happened in Lespar a few weeks after he had been removed. He was devastated at the news that the Gestapo had taken Giselle prisoner, and that no one knew where she was or if she was still alive. Arthur was unable to close his eyes that night, staring at the walls and ceilings of the maquis, shaking his head from time to time. Over the next 2 weeks, until the end of March 1944, Orange agents stealthily brought supplies and scraps of information to the Maquis. As his strength slowly returned, Arthur, like the others, tensed every time he heard a car or truck outside the hiding place. They always feared the Nazis would burst in after being tipped off by a local collaborator. The isolation and apprehension permeating the Maquis made Arthur and the others crave a return to the city. The camaraderie helped quell some nerves, but being stuck in the hideout was an ordeal. The very minutes, let alone hours and days, interminable. Several of the men spoke excellent English, but there were long stretches when the only sounds inside the damp, dark lair were coughs and snores. Whenever anyone left to relieve himself outside, he made certain that he found a spot completely concealed by woods and brush. Several times a day, the drone of small Henschel scout planes low in the sky above the tree line provided a stark reminder that they were all wanted men. No one left the Maquis during the day, except for a few armed men posted as sentries concealed outside. At night, a fresh set of guards kept up the vigil. Arthur was relieved that if the German showed up, he had a weapon. Whenever it rained, water pounded against the hideout's roof, and Arthur and the others were grateful that the rain did not leak through it. Still, dampness permeated the shelter. They could not even start a small fire to dry out their clothes, out of fear that the glow might reveal their location. The one indulgence they allowed themselves was a smoke, but only one man at a time, and only in the one corner of the building, where neither rain nor light penetrated. The only way the burning ash or whiffs of smoke could be seen there was if someone was literally looking inside the Maquis. A few farmers sympathetic to the resistance sneaked in cooked but cold pails of potatoes, radishes, and carrots for the men, as well as an occasional skinned and boiled rabbit or quail that the locals trapped in the woods. Several times, the locals brought eggs and bread. The men's stomachs were constantly growling, the meager portions barely enough to subsist on. Fortunately, farmers scrounged enough bottles of wine hidden from the Germans to allow Arthur and the others to ward off the chill from gusts that found their way into the windowless hiding place. Locals even furnished the occasional bottle of cognac on the chilliest evenings, as the men huddled beneath soggy woolen blankets against the bare stone walls. On those walls, men had defiantly scratched patriotic messages. Victoire! And Vive de Gaulle! Over and over, several men assured Arthur that he would soon be out of France and safe. He wanted to believe them, but as days went by without word from Toulouse, doubt seeped into him. Still, he believed that Taillandier would come for him. The Morange leader had always kept his word. Eventually, Pierre Delude decided he needed to be closer to his family in L'Espar, and decided to take the risk. Arthur was deeply saddened to see him go, but the urge to return to loved ones was one that he shared with Pierre. In the Maquis, his own thoughts were always less about himself than about how his parents, Seymour, and especially Esther were holding up. It helped when he and his new comrades spoke in low, hushed tones about their families. But those moments were few compared to the long hours each man was alone with his fears. No matter how deep the camaraderie of the Maquis, in those awful, endless moments, each man was utterly alone. In the apartment house on Finley Avenue in the Bronx, Rose Meyerowitz refused to abandon her conviction that her son Arthur was still alive. She simply felt that he was too intelligent and street-savvy not to have survived. She continued to write letters to the War Department, imploring officials for any scrap of information about Arthur. The replies were always the same. He was missing in action. Each day that passed without the most feared Western Union telegram of all, the killed in action notification, allowed Rose to hope for another day. the noncommittal replies from the War Department, signed by or for Adjutant General Robert H. Dunlap, were discouragingly similar to his response of April 21, 1944. Dear Mrs. Meyerowitz, it has been my fervent hope that favorable information would be forthcoming, and that you might be relieved from the great anxiety which you have borne during these months. It is therefore with deep regret that I must state that no further report in his, Arthur's, case has been forwarded to the War Department. The family also enlisted the help of friends and neighbors to inquire about Arthur's status. Max B. Goldman wrote to a War Department contact in early 1944, "I would consider it a great favor if you could obtain any further information possible in connection with this case, Arthur's status, and either call me by phone or wire me." David Meyerowitz went to work each day, trying to hold his own fears in check. For Seymour Meyerowitz, the wait was gut-wrenching. He prayed every day for his big brother's safe return, as Rose insisted he'd do. Still, Seymour saw the papers and the movie newsreels, the news of heavy losses in bombing raids over Hitler's fortress Europe. He tried to emulate his mother's faith that Arthur would come home. Alone at night with only his own thoughts, he was gnawed by doubt. For Esther Lowe, the strain was growing worse. David, Rose, and Esther's family grew increasingly worried about her as the weeks dragged on, and still no word came of Arthur's whereabouts. Esther knew other young women who had already received the news that boyfriends, fiancés, and husbands were never coming back. Rose constantly consoled Esther, urging her to hold on for Arthur's sake. Although Rose had nothing but faith to sustain that belief, it kept her going. She was convinced that her son was just the one who would beat the odds and make it home to them again. At the beginning of April 1944, Taillandier decided that it was time to bring Arthur back to Toulouse. Jeannot had arranged for a transfer of the two Gestapo agents who had interrogated the airman, and the agent who had stalked him had simply vanished without a trace. Arthur was elated when Taillandier came for him. He was ready physically and mentally to resume life as Georges Lambert, and glad to hear that he was even returning to 96 Boulevard del Tour. Although a few twinges of emotion tugged at him when his Maquis comrades hugged him and bade him a heartfelt bonne chance, he understood that they actually envied him because he was leaving. In another Maquis, a few miles outside of L'Espar, one of Arthur's early benefactors had been hiding from the Gestapo. Dr. Pierre Chauvin had endured about 2 weeks of abuse at the Gestapo's hands after he and Giselle had been seized. He did not reveal anything about Brutus or Arthur and was released. Giselle, however, remained imprisoned. They had been unable to break her at the Villa Calypso or the Fort Dua, but now she had been transferred to Fresnes prison. There, a new and even harsher regimen of starvation, sleep deprivation, and beatings awaited her as the Nazis attempted to pry information from her about her comrades. If she survived that, a concentration camp awaited her next. At Fresnes, some of the toughest resistance captives had finally given in to the abuse and blurted out names in hopes that the Nazis would end the agony with a bullet to the head. As Giselle and other female resistance fighters had heard, the Gestapo at Fresnes had cut off the heads of several women who refused to betray their comrades, and had done this slowly. Pierre returned home to find his mother-in-law, Mercedes, his maid, Simone, and his three children still at the house. Perhaps suspecting that the Gestapo had released him solely to shadow him in hopes he would lead them to other resistance operatives, he managed to sneak away undetected to a maquis about an hour from L'Espar in order to protect his family. He spent several weeks at the Maquis, providing medical treatment to other escapees. After his arrival, two of Simone's brothers came to the hideout after the Gestapo cracked down hard in and around L'Espar. They had been kicking down doors in search of Brutus' operatives and dragging them off to the Villa Calypso. As a message to the locals, the Germans seized several people who allegedly sympathized with the resistance and warned the townspeople that anyone who did not provide information about the shattered unit was under suspicion. With her daughter already arrested and perhaps dead, and with Pierre in hiding, Mercedes was worried that the Gestapo would return to the Chauvin home and haul her away, too. She took the three children to a Lespar neighbor. However, a few days later, she learned that the neighbor, likely concerned that she was also under suspicion, had taken the children a mile and a quarter away to a house in the town of Liard. It was near the Maquis. Nervously, Mercedes rushed there as fast as she could to pick up the children, pushing a small cart for the infant Patrick. On the road to Liard, several black sedans roared past her, followed by troop carriers filled with steel-helmeted German soldiers in their field-gray uniforms. Half-tracks, armored cars, with swivel turrets and heavy-caliber machine guns, brought up the caravan's rear. Mercedes realized that they were headed for the Maquis, but she could do nothing about it. It was too late. She had no idea whether Pierre was still there or not. She kept pushing the cart the last half mile to the house and waited for the first echoes of gunfire and explosions. Within 10 minutes, the sudden shrieks of birds pouring from trees to the rear alerted her. The din crashed down the road and all around her. Someone had likely managed to alert the men in the Maquis just before the Germans started to encircle the shelter. As covering fire from small firing holes punched into the lair's stone walls pelted the Germans, men spilled outside and scattered in all directions. Machine gun blasts downed several men as bazooka rounds pummeled the Maquis. Flames began to flare and then engulf the shelter. Defenders staggered out of the building, still firing, and were quickly cut down by the Germans. Gestapo officers strode up to the fallen fighters, kicked them, and put a single Luger round into each man's head just to be sure. One of Simone's brothers lay dead near the Maquis. The other was still running. Dozens of soldiers pursued Frenchmen deeper into the woods or across farmland. Only a handful eluded the relentless Germans. Pierre Chauvin was one of them. Just as she reached the house, she saw Jean-Claude and Monique peering out a window and heard Patrick wailing inside.
Mercedes turned as heavy footsteps thudded close by.
A young man, panting, his eyes wide and bulging, stumbled past her and fell against the door of a barn just across the street.
Three plainclothes Gestapo men in long black leather jackets were closing fast on the Frenchman and nearly knocked down Mercedes in their pursuit.
Each of the Germans held a gleaming Luger. One of the Nazis paused, aimed carefully, and squeezed off one round. It slammed into the young man's back and knocked him down onto the road. He lay there thrashing, trying to get up, his legs useless. Slowly, the trio walked up to him and pumped several bullets into his head.
Mercedes ran into the house.
Clutching the squalling Patrick, she told the older children to cover their eyes and to get into the cart. She handed Patrick to Monique and pushed the cart past the dead freedom fighter and the blood pooling around him. She looked straight ahead, refusing for the sake of the children to let the Gestapo see any trace of the fury and contempt simmering inside her. As Robert guided the Citroën from the Maquis, Marcel handed Arthur something, his identification card and papers. The American was headed back to Toulouse, but with no idea of how long he would have to remain there. He understood that when Taillandier believed the moment was right, he would orchestrate Arthur's escape immediately. Once again, Arthur would have to remain patient, but be ready to move in an instant.
It could not come soon enough for him. The arrest at the Frascati and the torture at the hands of the Gestapo had both terrified and enraged him. He wanted the chance to pay back a Gestapo agent or two before or even during the escape attempt. His hatred of the Nazis and their treatment of his French friends nearly matched his desire to see home again. Chapter 19. Meet Lieutenant Cleaver. In early April 1944, Arthur resumed his life as Georges Lambert in Toulouse. He left the house at 96 Boulevard del Tour each day except Sunday to help Monsieur Toulouse at the paint store. He constantly looked around on the streets for any sign of the Gestapo agent who had trailed him in March. After a week or so, the airman realized that Taillandier and his men had taken care of the problem. Toulouse had told neighbors that Georges had returned after a visit to family in Sulac-sur-Mer. Judging by the friendly nods and waves from them, Arthur was comfortable with the belief that locals took his host at his word. Although heartened by his sense that the Gestapo operative was not coming back, Arthur never let his guard down. Mirage operatives came and went from Toulouse's home. Just as before, Arthur knew them only by their first names. During his weeks at the Maquis, a major change had occurred for the people of Toulouse and the Nazi occupiers. The Allies had unleashed the controversial transportation plan full bore, with B-24s, B-17s, and British Halifax, Lancaster, and Stirling bombers pummeling any French rail centers that might help the Germans send reinforcements to the Atlantic coast after D-Day. Although the raids never targeted the center of Toulouse, they pounded rail lines, factories, German supply depots, bridges, and other military targets just outside the city. At night, the walls of Arthur's bedroom quaked from the not-so-distant bomb blasts, tiny bits of plaster falling around him. In the last days of March 1944, animated meetings at Toulouse's house among Taillandier, Jeannot, and other Mirage agents indicated that something big was up. It seemed especially true when Taillandier took Arthur to lunch at the Frascati on April 2nd, the first Sunday of the month. Arthur had not been back to the bistro since his return to Toulouse. If the Frenchman believed it was safe enough to take Georges Lambert to the café again, Arthur trusted his judgment. With the weather unseasonably warm, the bistro was packed. Even though the Frascati teemed with Nazis, this was the way that Taillandier and Mirage operated. Still, Arthur could not help but scan the café for any sign of the Gestapo agent who had seized him a few weeks earlier. Taillandier smiled and shook his head at the notion that he would have left such an important detail to chance. Taillandier was certain that on this mild Sunday afternoon, the police and Germans were more concerned with controlling revelers and enjoying the unofficial celebration of spring themselves. He had invited Jeannot and several other Mirage leaders to meet him in the Frascati to plot a daring raid against the local Gestapo. Arthur, wearing his well-rehearsed blank expression, was able to piece together just enough French to realize that Taillandier was detailing a coming ambush against the Gestapo. If he pulled it off, the action could yield more intelligence about the Gestapo, the police, and their collaborators than ever before. After lunch, Taillandier walked back with Arthur to 96 Boulevard del Tour and stepped inside to speak with Toulouse. Arthur turned to Taillandier and asked, "Can I go with you?" Marcel smiled faintly, respect glinting in his hard brown eyes, and shook his head. It was simply too risky. Arthur did not see Marcel for nearly a week after the meeting. The Frenchman finally reappeared at Toulouse's house the following Sunday. The Mirage strike against a heavily guarded Gestapo outpost on the fringe of the city
had yielded two large briefcases crammed with top-secret documents. The contents outlined upcoming Gestapo and police operations, as well as the names of informers. Over several glasses of wine with Arthur and Toulouse, Taillandier, speaking first in French and then in English for Arthur's sake, informed them that on the raid, Morange had rescued a top-priority prisoner from the Nazis. He was a Royal Air Force bomber squadron leader named Lieutenant Richard Frank Wharton, RFW Cleaver. Cleaver and his squadron, whose specialty was not unloading bombs but delivering munitions and supplies to drop zones for the French resistance, were crucial components of the preparations for D-Day in June 1944. He was part of the 644th Tactical Bomber Group, and the Germans knew how badly the British wanted him back and had intended to turn his capture into a propaganda coup through newsreels and radio conduits such as Axis Sally, the collective name American GIs gave to the German and Italian women who broadcasted propaganda for the Axis powers during the war. Taillandier told Arthur that it was vital that Cleaver be returned to his command, and that Morange was entrusting him to help with that mission. It was up to Arthur to show Cleaver the ropes and for the two men to protect each other, Taillandier explained. Inwardly, Arthur was elated that now he could actively help his French friends. The fact that Taillandier and his operatives trusted him to aid the escape of such a high-priority asset as Lieutenant Cleaver showed how highly they respected the American airman for his courage and endurance, as well as his ability to keep his head under stress. His instinctive decision to drop his photo identification and papers while being arrested by the Gestapo had proven his mettle to Morange. Further, his ability to keep quiet and not give up any information was a telling sign of the grit of the American. On the evening of Wednesday, April 5, 1944, at 10:30 p.m., the British crew of a Halifax B Mark V bomber of the 644th Squadron boarded their aircraft. At the throttle of the Halifax LL228A, for codename Able, was 24-year-old Squadron Commander Lieutenant RFW Cleaver. As they soared down the runway of the Royal Air Force Base at Tarrant Rushton, Dorset, in central England, Cleaver guided the bomber aloft and took the lead position in a formation of 44 Halifax and Stirling bombers, bound for targets in southern France. Cleaver, just 4 days short of his 25th birthday, was one of the RAF's best bomber pilots, already known for his coolness under fire and deft reflexes in the cockpit. In October 1943, he had been awarded the Distinguished Service Order, DSO, in recognition of gallantry and devotion to duty in the execution of air operations for No. 295 Squadron Royal Air Force during the invasion of Sicily. According to the citation, after successfully dropping a glider full of commandos at the target in Sicily, he returned to North Africa with a badly shot-up plane with three damaged engines. Cleaver's olive drab-colored bomber, with the usual distinctive red, white, and blue British bullseye circles on both sides of the fuselage, could reach a top speed of 275 miles per hour and a top cruising altitude of 15,000 feet. But his plane and the others that night were not loaded with bombs. Instead, his Halifax was crammed with arms, ammunition, and explosives for the resistance. The bomber's targets that night were designated drop zones in southwestern France where resistance fighters would be waiting. Cleaver and his fellow pilots that night had been specifically chosen for one of the war's most dangerous tasks, to fly no higher than 3,000 feet over the English Channel and occupied France in order to muddle German radar on the way to the drop zones. At such a low altitude, the bombers were more vulnerable to flak than usual. Smaller and lighter than the B-24, whose tail structure was similar, the Halifax could deliver nearly as many 500-pound bombs as the B-24. Cleaver's mission fell under the command of Great Britain's Special Operations Executive, SOE. After the fall of France in 1940, the SOE was created to aid sabotage and subversion behind enemy lines in France. Cleaver's job was to drop vital supplies and munitions there so that the resistance could blow up trains, bridges, and factories. If the Gestapo got their hands on pilots delivering supplies to the resistance, they were treated no better than captured resistance fighters. As Cleaver led his squadron over the channel, the crew settled in for their long flight to a drop zone in the department of Charente-Maritime, near the southwestern coast of France. They flew less than 1,000 feet above the churning whitecaps. A resistance unit called Bir Hakem would be waiting at the drop zone, if all went according to plan. Cleaver noticed that there was a good moon that night. That meant that visibility for low-flying planes was good, but the German observers could spot the planes by eye, even if the radar did not pick up the formation. Frank Cleaver was proud of the 644th, whose motto was, "We sow the seeds of the dragon." A fitting term for the cargo in the Halifax's bomb bay. Flying with Cleaver that night was the 5-man crew he had come to trust and respect on 14 previous drops to the resistance. Pilot Officer Norman Wyatt, Navigator Flight Sergeant John Franklin, Wireless Operator Flight Sergeant Donald J. Hoddenott, Rear Gunner Sergeant Alan Matthews, and Bomb Aimer and Flight Engineer Sergeant Raymond Hindle. The co-pilot, Wyatt, like Cleaver, was university-educated and hailed from Britain's upper middle class, which was still called the gentry. The rest of the crew came from the lower reaches of Britain's class system. But in the Halifax, none of the social conventions held true. The men were united in purpose and tightly knit in the air and on the ground. And Cleaver insisted every crew member call him Frank. If not for World War II, Richard Frank Wharton Cleaver's path would likely have ensconced him in a comfortable role in the family shipping business, memberships at upscale gentlemen's clubs, and an equally comfortable marriage and home life in Kent. He was engaged to Dorothy Elliott, an attractive schoolteacher from an upscale family. Cleaver was born on April 9, 1920, in Portland, Maine, while his parents were visiting relatives in that state and Boston. There was never a question of dual citizenship. He was English, pure and simple. A top student and gifted athlete with wavy blonde hair and blue eyes, Cleaver was schooled at the Seven Oaks School, one of England's oldest and most prestigious private academies, where he was a star runner for the Kentish school's track team. He also had a passion for fast cars and airplanes. Against his parents' wishes, he took flying lessons while at university. When World War II broke out, Cleaver's choice of service was clear. He enlisted in the Royal Air Force in the fall of 1940. His preference was fighter planes, but his leadership skills and calm personality led his superiors to believe that he was perfectly suited to lead entire crews into action rather than fly solo in a Spitfire or Hurricane fighter. As Cleaver approached the coastline of France, he and the other bombers increased their altitude to 3,000 feet and readied themselves for the gauntlet, the gut-wrenching flight above Nazi 88s. Their luck held as they drew closer to the drop zone. Despite the glowing moon, there were no bursts of anti-aircraft fire. Yet. Nearing the drop zone, Bomb Aimer Sergeant Hindle checked their payload. Cylindrical C and H steel containers equipped with a parachute. The Cs were 69 inches long and loaded with rifles, pistols, and automatic weapons for the Bir Hakem unit. Each weighed up to 224 pounds. The Hs were the same size, but could be broken down into 5 smaller sections for the fighters on the ground. Although the H container was easier to carry and conceal for the resistance, the sections could not hold long items such as rifles.
The H-type was perfect for ammunition, explosives, boots, blankets, and radio equipment. As the Charente River appeared on Cleaver's left side, and the Atlantic on his right, he peered out for the tiny glint of 6 bicycle lamps, the prearranged signal for the drop zone. Standing in the cockpit right behind him, Navigator Flight Sergeant John Franklin checked the distance to the drop zone on his map, using the river as a landmark, and gave Cleaver a report every 60 seconds. If Cleaver did not detect the contact signal, or had any doubts about the drop zone, he had the option to abort the mission and lead the formation back home. Franklin told Cleaver that the drop zone was directly ahead. From the ground, there was only darkness. Cleaver wondered if the resistance had not reached the DZ, drop zone, because the Nazis had been tipped off somehow. He decided to scrap the delivery and turn back for England. As the squadron banked back toward the coast, flak burst all around the bomber above a German airfield near Cognac. Cleaver immediately yanked the throttle hard to peel away from the 88s, but shrapnel tore into the starboard wing and set it ablaze. The bomber quaked violently and began to lose altitude. Cleaver recognized immediately that the Halifax was finished. He ordered his crew to bail out while there was still, barely, enough time and distance between the plane and the ground for their parachutes to deploy. Jumping from 3,000 feet meant a hard or even fatal landing. But it was his crew's only chance. Remaining at the controls to allow his crew to escape, Cleaver fought to keep the plane level, but she was losing height rapidly. With all of his men out, but the Halifax now at 1,000 feet and plunging, he had no chance to jump. His only hope was to crash land. With the bomber packed with the ammunition and the explosives intended for the resistance, Cleaver figured the Halifax would explode on impact. Unfamiliar with the ground, he attempted to put the lurching, flaming Halifax down in a field cloaked in mist. In the darkness, only the shadowy tops of trees were visible as he braced himself for landing. The plane slammed against the ground and skidded to a stop. As flames that would soon bring the Germans to the crash site engulfed the plane, he crawled through the shattered glass windshield of the bomber. He staggered into the brush as German armored personnel carriers swarmed the site. Within minutes, the bomber exploded in a column of fire and smoke. Several men in black Gestapo uniforms found Cleaver, beat him, and handcuffed him. They threw him into a sedan and headed down a road with several other vehicles. One of the Gestapo agents looked at Cleaver's RAF identification card. He informed him they were going to make a public example of him and show people what happened to those who aided resistance gangsters. The Nazis drove him just outside Toulouse and imprisoned him in a stone blockhouse that adjoined a farmhouse and large stone barn that the Gestapo used to interrogate prisoners and store files. They stripped him of his clothing, and for the next 2 days, he was interrogated and beaten, either tied to a chair or chained by his ankle to a wall. On the third night, April 9th, 1944, shouts and small arms fire broke out from all directions outside the blockhouse. A grenade blast blew open the front door. The shockwave shook the walls around Cleaver and stunned him. Agonized screams echoed above submachine gun bursts, and pounding footsteps neared the room where Cleaver lay slumped against a wall. The wooden door was kicked open in a shower of splinters. A moment later, several men rushed inside with automatic weapons. Cleaver thought they were about to kill him. Instead, a Frenchman with a mustache and a beret pulled low across his brow, freed the pilot from the chain with a single pistol shot. Two of the man's comrades helped Cleaver from the building to a dark sedan near several other similar cars. At least 10 Germans lay sprawled, bleeding, and motionless in and around the blockhouse.
Several single shots from inside the adjacent farmhouse testified that no Nazis had been spared. The resistance group's leader, the man with the mustache, introduced himself to Cleaver in English as Marcel. Arthur's mission to help the famed RAF pilot attempt an escape that could end fatally for both men was about to begin. Chapter 20. Unlikely Friends. The Mirage sedan carrying the injured RAF pilot sped across the Pont Neuf, across the Garonne River, and cut from the highway to a series of side streets close to the center of Toulouse. To the south, bright flashes lit the night sky. Concussive shockwaves rolled through the city, shaking roads and buildings. The RAF was hammering German positions and railways outside Toulouse. As usual, no one stopped the sinister-looking Citroën, the Nazis assuming it was one of theirs. Just a few blocks from the Boulevard del Tour, the car stopped in front of a brick apartment house. Two Mirage agents hustled Lieutenant Cleaver inside the building, and up to the top floor, where the door was slightly ajar. A slight, 60-ish woman with gray hair pulled back in a tight bun was waiting for them. The operatives led Cleaver into an annex, laid him atop an old iron-framed bed, and raced back downstairs to the sedan. It vanished down the street seconds later. A doctor was waiting inside and examined the Englishman, who was covered with bruises and cuts, and whose blonde hair was plastered with sweat and dried blood. The physician stitched several gashes and bound up several broken ribs. Then he injected the pilot with a small dose of morphine. Although Cleaver was grateful to be in a real bed and safe for the time being, and despite his morphine-induced state, the window-rattling explosions of the RAF night raids pulled him in and out of a restless sleep. His muddled thoughts drifted back to the crash, and he strained to remember how many of his crew's parachutes he had counted as he fought to keep his burning Halifax in the air as long as possible. He was certain that Pilot Officer Norman Wyatt, in the seat next to him, had gotten out. Cleaver thought he had counted 5 chutes, but was concerned that the jump from such a low altitude could have injured or killed his men. At least he had held the bomber aloft long enough to give them their only chance of survival. As Cleaver hovered on the edge of consciousness, his own chances of survival hinged not only on the man named Marcel and his operatives, but also on the diminutive, slightly hunched woman in wire-rimmed glasses. Marie-Louise Dessart was a resistance member responsible for running the most successful escape line for downed Allied airmen. At the moment that Cleaver had been brought to her, she was a wanted woman by the Gestapo and police. That fact had not slowed down her resistance activities in Toulouse. 64-year-old Marie-Louise Dessart was born in Toulouse in 1880. After the fall of France in June 1940, Dessart, who burned with a fierce love of her nation and a hatred of the Germans and their Vichy collaborators, joined the resistance. She would soon find herself working with the British Special Operations Executive, SOE, Officer Ian Garrow, and Belgian Naval Officer Albert Gayrice, in a clandestine escape network dubbed the Pat O'Leary Line. The name was coined by Gayrice, who had told German captors that he was Pat O'Leary, a Canadian officer. Using the code name Françoise, Dessart operated out of her Toulouse apartment. There, she and Garrow set up a complex web of safe houses and couriers in Toulouse, Marseille, and Perpignan, at the approaches of the Pyrenees Mountains between France and Spain. Both Garrow and Gayrice were eventually arrested in 1941, and both escaped with the aid of Françoise. Dessart took command of the O'Leary network. Her age and appearance worked to her advantage,
and to that of more than 250 airmen she helped to escape. World War II historian Michael Grant writes, "Because of her relatively advanced age, the Gestapo did not suspect that she was a member of the resistance. This gave her considerable freedom to travel throughout France, arranging escapes for airmen. Her customary procedure was to escort airmen to Toulouse, where, through the network, she arranged lodgings. From here, they were moved to Perpignan and transferred to the care of local guides for the trek across the Pyrenees. In the Toulouse annex, the injured pilot had no idea who the woman was, and no idea that she was in even more trouble than he was. Cleaver assumed the apartment was hers, but she was, in fact, also hiding out there, several blocks from her own home. The Gestapo had seized one of the network's guides in Perpignan in January 1944, and found a notebook on him, even though the guides were never supposed to write down any operative's name. Several pages contained Dessart's name. When a Morange plant in the Toulouse Gestapo alerted Dessart that the Nazis had her name, resistance leaders urged her to go underground. For Françoise Dessart, keeping a low profile contradicted her very nature. Described as an old woman with a very loud voice by one of the airmen she rescued, she had yelled at and cursed the Gestapo and police on a regular basis in the streets of Toulouse. Often she walked up to German soldiers, and especially Gestapo agents, wagged a finger in their faces, and unleashed a torrent of insults and swears at them. Always, she went out with her cat, which led neighbors and Nazis alike to dub her as the Cat Lady. Because of her aged appearance, the Germans believed her to be eccentric or outright crazy, and left her alone. Normally, they would have immediately arrested anyone else for such defiance. The Gestapo had never suspected that the verbally abusive Cat Lady was the main safe house keeper and organizer for the Pas-d'Oliry line in the south of France. A British airman whom she helped to escape wrote, "Due to her efforts, the line stayed open. She often gave abuse to the enemy who thought her eccentric. She stood no nonsense, trusted no one. Her cat, Miff, went everywhere with her, and he lived to 18 years of age." Much of that changed when the Nazis seized the guide's notebook. Dessart went into hiding, but on her own terms, which meant she refused to abandon her work to help Allied airmen to safety. Taking refuge for several weeks in attics, cellars, and garages in and around Toulouse, she still ventured out from time to time with forged photo identification cards and papers. She correctly calculated that her appearance was that of any number of aging widows in the city, her features and manner of dress common and unremarkable. She made subtle changes to her appearance, arranging her hair in a bun instead of the coiled braid she wore in her original photo identification card. She donned wire-rimmed glasses that were absent in her original photo as well, and let her hair go completely gray. The Gestapo was hunting for her, but she remained one step ahead of them. Taillandier, who visited Cleaver several times during the pilot's first week in Toulouse, told Arthur to be ready to meet the Englishman soon. Arthur asked Taillandier about the man, wondering if Cleaver was one of those upper-class British officers whose air of superiority, even haughtiness, so grated on Americans who had grown up with little and worked hard for everything they had. At first, many raucous 8th and 15th U.S. Army Air Corps crewmen and pilots, reacting to the extreme mannerness and reserve of the British Blue Bloods, had mistakenly thought them effete. They quickly came to realize that many of those lads of the finishing schools had climbed into the cockpits of rugged Hurricane and sleek Spitfire fighter planes and bested the Luftwaffe in the Battle of Britain. Others, such as Cleaver, controlled the throttles of RAF bombers pounding Axis Europe with their allies or running dangerous supply drops to the resistance. In Toulouse's parlor, Taillandier described how Cleaver had stayed with his plane
to make sure his entire crew had gotten out. Arthur's eyes met Taiyandie's through the usual swirl of smoke from the cigarette in his hand. The fact that Cleaver